trash.com.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It is Wednesday, February 20th, 2013. Hackers in the news all over the world. And while we're talking about the internet, I'd like to mention for all of our listeners that the Peter B. Collins Daily News and Comment free podcast is available for your mobile phone download and listening pleasure at Stitcher.com. Check it out. Hackers from Shanghai, China, reputed to be employed by the People's Liberation Army and assigned to Unit 61398, have been traced as the hacking unit that has broken into a lot of America's internet infrastructure. Yesterday, here in the U.S., a major media offensive was launched by a relatively unknown cybersecurity firm called Mandiant, M-A-N-D-I-A-N-T. It is named for its founder, Kevin Mandia. And they claim that they have traced and used other sources to confirm that in Shanghai, China, there is a 12-story office building where the comment crew, or the so-called Shanghai group, which has been accused of hacking into many corporate and government websites here in the West, it's where they operate from. And on the PBS NewsHour last night, a spokesperson for Mandiant indicated that they were able to find some open-source documents that showed that in a demand for telephone service, that it had been revealed that the PLA's Unit 61398 is located in a specific building that they have traced cyber attacks to in Shanghai, China. Now, this is all declassified public information, and it is being used to try to detail for people the level of the threats that have occurred. Now, I'm reading a report from the New York Times, which does properly disclose that Mandiant was hired by the Times to investigate a sophisticated Chinese origin attack on its news operations and web infrastructure. But it was concluded that that was not the work of Comment Crew, but a different Chinese group. And they say that Mandiant isn't currently working for the Times company, but they're in discussions to set up some sort of a long-term deal. And we understand that Comment Crew, as it's called, has drained terabytes of data from companies like Coca-Cola. They've also downloaded information on the U.S. electrical power grid, gas lines, waterworks. One company was that was targeted had remote access to more than 60% of oil and gas pipelines in the U.S. Now, China denies it all, says that these are all unfounded claims, and says that China itself is a victim of computer hacking, which is probably true. And we are probably the aggressors in this case. Belatedly, the Pentagon has announced that in the coming year, they're going to beef up our cyber warfare and defensive capabilities. And as I have discussused previously, related to the Stuxnet virus that we inserted into Iranian nuclear facility computers, this is an act of war. And there's been no debate, there's been no authorization from Congress for the military or any other branch of our government to wage cyber warfare. We've got some catching up to do. Meanwhile, the group Anonymous, which is from what I can understand, and since they're anonymous, I can't prove this, but we believe this group originally originated among dissidents in the Scientology Church. And then when Occupy was targeted, the Anonymous group came to its defense. Well, we have a report from Australia that over the past weekend, the long holiday weekend, Anonymous hacked into the United States State Department website and captured a database and apparently has the name and email addresses and other information on virtually every employee of the U.S. State Department. This appears to be revenge for the recent suicide of Aaron Swartz, Swartz was his name. There was no CH in there, Swartz. And also, they say that it is for the arrests of hackers who were part of the group Lulzsec. And Anonymous also is reportedly behind a hack into a public website in Israel, which I think is the loose equivalent of Yahoo, where they dumped 600,000 user accounts. So there is a cyber war going on all around us these days. Then, of course, we've got the drones, another form of warfare that hasn't been properly authorized or debated. And in our in-depth interview, currently available for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, we talk about drones and their domestic use. And our guest is Nadia Kayali, who is a legal fellow at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And she has been active in supporting activists who oppose the expansion of drone use into law enforcement circles here in the United States. And I'm going to link to a pretty good article in my morning San Francisco Chronicle today about the debate over these issues. And as I point out in my conversation with Nadia Kayali, one of the things that's fascinating is that Americans are much more concerned about the deployment of drones in our own backyards by the law enforcement agencies that we know best, that we're closest to, than our elected officials are in dealing with this new technology, this new form of warfare at the federal level and at the international level. But it's interesting to see last Thursday on Valentine's Day, there was a hearing in the Alameda County Board of Supervisors. Alameda is the county that includes Oakland, but it's a sprawling county that expands well beyond the city limits. And the supervisors have been presented with a request from the county sheriff. He wants a 4.5-pound aerial, unmanned aerial vehicle. He doesn't like to call it a drone. And its only capability is to carry a video camera. It's got a 25-mile range. And the obvious use of it is for surveillance. And because Alameda County includes Oakland, where we have a rogue police department, and we still have officers who have not been held accountable, and we still have officers who have not been properly held accountable for their wrongdoing during the Occupy protests a year and a half ago, there is great concern in the citizenry. And there were a whole range of people who spoke at this hearing who opposed it, and only one who supported it. Here's an excerpt from my conversation about the issue of drones for law enforcement in Alameda County with Nadia Kayali.
The sheriff has been very insistent about using the phrase unmanned aerial vehicle as opposed to drone, even though I think most of us would agree what we're talking about people would think of as a drone. And part of that is for the reason that the sheriff wants to is characterizing what he's going to use this for. Now, I think when most people say drone, they're connecting it to military technology that can be used, of course, in targeted killings, but also in surveillance. The sheriff has repeatedly stated that he would want to use the drone in particular for emergency situations as well as search and rescue, hazardous spills, things like that. However, right before the meeting, the sheriff issued a draft policy which had 10 different uses for the drone. And these uses included post-crime evidence preservation, as well as incidents where there would be probable cause to find evidence of a crime being committed. So the policy that the sheriff submitted to the Board of Supervisors as well as to civil rights advocates actually had a wide range of uses and very little control on that wide range.
Mm-hmm.
So although the sheriff has said, again, he's repeatedly said search and rescue, it's clear that he would want to use this for surveillance, for spying, which really practically, you mentioned the drone was 4.4 pounds. That's exactly what this drone is best at doing. Mm-hmm. It's not particularly well-suited for the kind of uses that he really stressed. It's much more well-suited for the kinds of uses that he sort of quietly included in the policy.
You can hear the full interview with Nadia Kayali. It is segment 2 in the current in-depth interview podcast, available for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And this is where I ask you to become a subscriber. I need your support to keep this operation going and make it all work out. For $1, you get a 24-hour pass, $5 for a month, $50 a year. All the details are under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Just click on the links there. And speaking of drones, the number of American drone strikes in Afghanistan last year rose sharply. And in an Associated Press report, they linked this to a kind of expansion of the battle footprint as we prepare to leave Afghanistan. And I'm not sure there is an actual connection there in terms of the strategy. But the steep rise in the number of weapons shows up this way. 506 weapons were released by drones in 2012, compared with 294 the previous year. And the official government story, which we know is hardly true, is that 5 incidents resulted in casualties with 16 civilians killed and 3 wounded, up from just 1 incident, and we know that's a lie, from 2011. So here's a quick rundown for you. In 2009, we fired missiles 243 times from drones. In 2010, it was 277. 2011, 294. And then 494 in 2012. And that's the Air Force Central Command, which is actually separate from the UN mission. And, of course, the CIA launches drone strikes, too. So these are low-ball numbers, but still shocking to see. In Washington now, the latest drama continues to unfold related to the automatic budget cuts that are supposed to take effect March 1, the so-called sequestration, and we're now at the cruel hoax stage. In order to dramatize the urgency of the situation and to try to fear people up against any cuts whatsoever at the Pentagon, the Defense Department has issued notices to 800,000 civilian employees. And essentially, the threat is that if the cuts go through next week, they will be placed on periods of unpaid leave. And so this is the game that we're playing now, where we have to put 800,000 people and their families into limbo over a game that is entirely being played within the Congress. Now, I'll go over it once again, and I'm sorry if this gets tiresome for you. But Republicans in Congress demanded this when they set up the phony conflict over the extension of the debt level in the summer of 2011. This is John Boehner's baby. And these automatic cuts were supposed to be so brutal that it would force the super committee into coming up with a plan to reduce the annual budget deficit and reduce the long-term debt. Having done neither, we now get into this gamesmanship about what could happen. And of course, Congress can easily just delay this once again. These cuts were supposed to take effect January 1st, and they put them on hold. They could do that again. It's all a big game. And now they're putting working people on the line. These are, what did Saddam call them? Human shields. And once again, it is a concoction that is completely owned and controlled lock, stock, and barrel by the Republican leaders in the House of Representatives. Here's the other game they're playing that is so cruel. There used to be a game called Post Office. I think it's a party game and you drink and kiss and take your clothes off. It's been a while for me. But the Post Office game we're playing these days is that a few years back, Congress required the Postal Service to prepay retiree health benefits for the next frickin' 75 years. I mean, some of the people who might receive those benefits have not even started working at the post office yet. And while the paper deficits at the Postal Service have started to ratchet up in the last few years, and it's technically insolvent now, it's all bullshit. This, once again, is a concoction, a creation of extremist Republicans in Congress. And I'm pleased to say that finally, some saner folks have said, well, let's fix this. Peter DeFazio, a progressive congressman from Southern Oregon, Bernie Sanders, independent senator from Vermont, have similar legislation introduced in each house. And it would not only fix this pre-funding of 75 years of health care benefits, but it would loosen some of the restrictions on the post office. For example, you go into a post office now, there's often a lot of empty space. They've laid people off. They've got these big, beautiful lobbies. They're not allowed to sub-rent, sublease that space. They could put package services, they could put FedEx stations in there. There are a lot of different ways that the Postal Service, if some of the restrictions were relaxed, could become more competitive. And of course, you know, one of the elephants that's never talked about is the cost of bulk mail. Junk mail, magazines, newspapers. That stuff rides at the lowest rates. And modest increases to junk mail costs, number one, might reduce the amount of junk mail I'm getting, and I wouldn't be offended by that, but it could raise more money for the Postal Service and help them balance their books. Those rates, by the way, those are set by Congress. And so once again, the elected officials have created this mess. The solution is right within their grasp. Will they act on it? I kind of doubt it. They want to see Saturday delivery go away. They feel like that's a good boost for big corporate donors to political campaigns called FedEx and UPS. Recently, because of the release of the Obama targeted killing white paper from the Justice Department and a few other issues, we're seeing people join me. And I don't say this to pat myself on the back. Some of you may have gotten tired of my continued coverage of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the rendition program. We just talked with Steve Hendricks about the bungled kidnap in Milan that occurred 10 years ago this February. But I'm pleased to see that I'm getting a little company. Lead editorial in the New York Times a couple of days ago was about the black sites. Talks about the report that we have cited here that 54 nations supported our rendition program, either by letting us kidnap people on their soil, letting us overfly their airspace, some of them let us use prisons and some of them let us use torture, or let us use their people to torture our detainees. And Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has said that the 6,000-page report that is still classified says that the operation of black sites and the use of torture were terrible mistakes. And coming from her, that's quite a statement. If she supports the expanded presidential powers and the creation of the domestic police state as much as any Republican does. And as I pointed out, we're still missing about 20 of the 136 suspects who were renditioned or detained in black sites. And I'm glad to hear from the New York Times on this issue. Also, I want to point out that Rachel Maddow, who has had the cuffs lifted from her coverage because it's not an election year, she doesn't have to protect the Democrats and President Obama anymore, she opened her program last night with a lengthy segment, raising important questions that you've heard here about why do we need Guantanamo? Why can't we try these people in federal court? Why do we need kangaroo court military commissions? She gave an update on the prison, the max prison built in Illinois, that the state of Illinois has never opened and can't afford to run, and it was quietly purchased by the U.S. Justice Department last year. It's the perfect place to park the people who were told cannot be released from Guantanamo. And I appreciate that Rachel went into depth on that and spoke about it passionately. It's been a kind of lonely on this beat. Also, over the weekend, a troubling story surfaced, and I waited to confirm it. The report is that on Sunday afternoon, after his golf outing with Tiger Woods and the oil baron, that President Obama signed a presidential memorandum that waives the enforcement of the law that he supported when he was a senator, called the Child Soldier Prevention Act. It is a law that restricts the government's military support to nations that fail to stop recruiting child soldiers into their armed forces. And he signed a waiver. Turns out it's for the fourth year in a row. And Chloe doesn't like that. She's piping up here. A waiver that says that we can provide military aid to countries despite the fact that they recruit child soldiers. The waiver applies to the nations of Libya, South Sudan, Yemen, and the Republic of the Congo. Now, I'm waiting to hear the rationale behind this. I don't know what level of military aid we're currently giving to South Sudan, for example. We know about Yemen, we know about Libya, and the Republic of the Congo? I don't know what our level of military support is and why we need to waive the child soldier restriction in that case. Stunning figures on the death from drug overdoses in the United States. In 2010, the most recent year the figures are available for, 38,329 Americans died of drug overdose deaths. 60% were for prescription drugs. That's a shocking number. When you think about people who OD, you think about people who use heroin or people who go crazy on methamphetamine. But 60% are from widely available prescription drugs. 3 out of 4 of these medication overdose deaths are from Vicodin and OxyContin. These are the hydrocodone drugs. That's what Rush Limbaugh got hooked on, and I'm not going to make fun of him, at least not today. This is a deplorable number. It's something that can be easily fixed. These are Schedule I drugs. And yet we see the billions wasted and the lives lost in the war on some drugs, aimed at marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. And to some extent, meth. I don't want to exclude that. But you can see how misplaced this is just in terms of the number of people who die from abusing drugs. I don't know of a single person who died from an overdose of marijuana. And yet the Obama administration expanded the crackdown on medical pot clinics here in California, and the interaction between federal and state law is a huge mess. But you can't go there, you can't talk about it, you can't debate it, you can't fix it, because the war on drugs is sacrosanct. You simply can't go there. We have an update on Republican love childs. 80-year-old former Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico has finally admitted that 30 years ago he fathered a child outside his marriage.
You think that I don't feel love, but what I feel for you is real love. In others' eyes I see reflected, I hurt, scorned, rejected love child. Never meant to be,
Now, this is an all-Republican sex scandal. Senator Domenici knocked up the daughter of Senator Paul Laxalt of Nevada. This occurred in 1978. The child was born in August of 78, 35 years ago, to Michelle Laxalt, who at that point was the 24-year-old daughter of the senator from Nevada. And Pete Domenici was 46, so he was 22 years her senior at that time. Now, Pete Domenici is a prolific, manly guy. He had 8 children with his wife, plus this Laxalt love baby. Michelle Laxalt, the daughter of former Senator Paul Laxalt, is a well-connected activist on Republican circles in Washington. And the senator said, well, she made me promise not to tell anybody. Oh, boy. Of course, Pete Domenici, you look at his track record, he was a solid anti-abortion vote every time. A hardliner on contraception. Federal funding for it. Perhaps he has some regrets now in that department. And finally today, a curious development here in the city of San Francisco. For many years now, the cops have wanted to add tasers to the gun belts of police officers. And the previous police chief, who is now the district attorney, George Gascon, made the case and failed. And what's interesting is the new police chief, Greg Suhr, who rose up through the ranks, he's an insider. He's now asking the police commission to approve the limited deployment of what they call stun guns. Now, I find the language choice very interesting here. Because in the media coverage, and in a Chronicle editorial that I'm looking at right now, they show the picture of a taser. That's what everybody knows them as. And tasers got a really bad reputation a couple of years ago in the infamous case of Oscar Grant, who was killed by a BART cop who said, oh, I grabbed my pistol, I thought I was grabbing my taser. And so we don't call them tasers, but they are tasers. And the cops have trotted out a case from about a year ago. Last summer, there was a man working in a factory who reportedly went bonkers at lunchtime. And in a confrontation with police, he was shot and killed. And they say, well, you know, if we just had a stun gun, we wouldn't have had to kill him. And that's kind of seductive, isn't it? You think, well, I'd rather shock somebody with a high-voltage blast than kill them. But people die from tasers. And the safety and efficacy of them is quite dubious in my mind. And the police chief says, well, we're only going to allow certain officers who are certified in dealing with mental health and drug issues, and they will have to keep a defibrillator handy in case a shot from a taser stops somebody's heart. Well, I'm against it. I think that there are non-lethal ways to subdue people, short of firing the sidearms, and that don't require the deployment of stun guns, whether you call them tasers or not. Thanks for joining me for news and comment today. Go ahead and share this podcast all over the damn place. I dare you.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.